a secret any more among men in this world. Myself and Grendel coming to grips on the very spot where he visited destruction on the victory shieldings, and violated life and limb, losses I avenged, so no earthly offspring of Grendel's need ever boast of that bout before dawn, no matter how long the last of his evil family survives. When I first landed, I hastened to the Ring Hall and saluted Hrothgar. Once he discovered why I had come, the son of Halfdane sent me immediately to sit with his own sons on the bench. It was a happy gathering. In my whole life I have never seen mead enjoyed more in any hall on earth. Sometimes the queen herself appeared, peace pledge between nations, to hearten the young ones and hand out a talk to a warrior, then take her place. Sometimes Hrothgar's daughter distributed ale to older ranks, in order on the benches. I heard the company call her Freyawaru as she made her rounds, presenting men with the gem-studded bowl. Young bride-to-be to the gracious Ingeld, in her gold-trimmed attire. The friend of the Shieldings favors her betrothal. The guardian of the kingdom sees good in it, and hopes this woman will heal old wounds and grievous feuds. But generally the spear is prompt to retaliate when a prince is killed, no matter how admirable the bride may be. Think how the Hathabards will be bound to feel, their lord, Ingeld, and his loyal thanes, when he walks in with that woman to the feast. Danes are at the table, being entertained, honored guests in glittering regalia, burnished ring mail that was their host's birthright, looted when the Hathabards could no longer wield their weapons in the shield clash, when they went down with their beloved comrades and forfeited their lives. Then an old spearman will speak while they are drinking, having glimpsed some heirloom that brings alive memories of the massacre. His mood will darken, and heart-stricken in the stress of his emotion, he will begin to test a young man's temper and stir up trouble. Starting like this, "Now, my friend, don't you recognize your father's sword, his favorite weapon, the one he wore when he went out in his war mask to face the Danes on that final day?" After Weathergell died and his men were doomed, the Shieldings quickly claimed the field, and now here's a son of one or other of those same killers coming through our hall, overbearing us, mouthing boasts, and rigged in armor that by right is yours. And so he keeps on, recalling and accusing, working things up with bitter words, until one of the lady's retainers lies spattered in blood, split open on his father's account. The killer knows the lie of the land and escapes with his life. Then on both sides the oath-bound lords will break the peace. A passionate hate will build up in Ingeld, and love for his bride will falter in him as the feud rankles. I therefore suspect the good faith of the Hathabards, the truth of their friendship and the trustworthiness of their alliance with the Danes. But now, my lord, I shall carry on with my account of Grendel, the whole story of everything that happened in the hand-to-hand fight. After Heaven's gem had gone mildly to earth, that maddened spirit, the terror of those twilights, came to attack us where we stood guard, still safe inside the hall. There, deadly violence came down on Hanshiel, and he fell as fate ordained, the first to perish, rigged out for the combat. A comrade from our ranks had come to grief in Grendel's maw. He ate up the entire body. There was blood on his teeth. He was bloated and furious, all roused up, yet still unready to leave the hall empty-handed. Renowned for his might, he matched himself against me, wildly reaching. He had this roomy pouch, a strange accoutrement, intricately strung and hung at the ready, a rare patchwork of devilishly fitted dragon skins. I had done him no wrong, yet the raging demon wanted to cram me and many another into this bag. But it was not to be, once I got to my feet in a blind fury. It would take too long to tell how I repaid the terror of the land for every life he took, and so won credit for you, my king, and for all your people. and although he got away to enjoy life's sweetness for a while longer, his right hand stayed behind him in Herat, evidence of his miserable overthrow as he dived into murk on the mere bottom. I got lavish rewards from the Lord of the Danes for my part in the battle. Beaten gold and much else. Once morning came and we took our places at the banquet table. There were singing and excitement. An old reciter, a carrier of stories, recalled the early days. At times, some hero made the timbered harp tremble with sweetness, or related true and tragic happenings. At times the king gave the proper turn to some fantastic tale, or a battle-scarred veteran, bowed with age, would begin to remember the martial deeds of his youth and prime and be overcome as the past welled up in his wintry heart. We were happy there the whole day long, and enjoyed our time until another night descended upon us. Then, suddenly, the vehement mother avenged her son and wreaked destruction. Death had robbed her. Geats had slain Grendel, so his ghastly dam struck back and with bare-faced defiance laid a man low. Thus life departed from the sage Asherah, an elder wise in counsel. But afterwards, on the morning following, the Danes could not burn the dead body nor lay the remains of the man they loved on his funeral pyre. She had fled with the corpse and taken refuge beneath torrents on the mountain. It was a hard blow for Hrothgar to bear, harder than any he had undergone before. And so the heartsore king beseeched me in your royal name to take my chances underwater, to win glory and prove my worth. He promised me rewards. Hence, as is well known, I went to my encounter with the terrormonger at the bottom of the tarn. For a while it was hand to hand between us. Then blood went curling along the currents, and I beheaded Grendel's mother in the hall with a mighty sword. I barely managed to escape with my life. My time had not yet come. But Halfdane's heir, the shelter of those earls, again endowed me with gifts in abundance. Thus the king acted with due custom. I was paid and recompensed completely, given full measure and the freedom to choose from Hrothgar's treasures by Hrothgar himself. These, King Hugalak, I am happy to present to you as gifts. It is still upon your grace that all favor depends. I have few kinsmen who are close, my king, except for your kind self. Then he ordered the boar-framed standard to be brought, the battle-topping helmet, the mail shirt gray as hoar-frost, and the precious war-sword, and proceeded with his speech. When Hrothgar presented this war-gear to me, he instructed me, my lord, to give you some account of why it signifies his special favor. He said it had belonged to his older brother, King Haragar, who had long kept it, but that Haragar had never bequeathed it to his son, Hereward, that worthy scion, loyal as he was. Enjoy it well. I heard four horses were handed over next. Beowulf bestowed four bay steeds to go with the armor, swift gallopers all alike. So ought a kinsman act, instead of plotting and planning in secret to bring people to grief, or conspiring to arrange the death of comrades. The warrior king was uncle to Beowulf, and honored by his nephew. Each was concerned for the other's good. I heard he presented Hugh with a gorget, the priceless torque that the prince's daughter, Wealtheo, had given him, and three horses, supple creatures, brilliantly saddled. The bright necklace would be luminous on Hugh's breast. Thus Beowulf bore himself with valor. He was formidable in battle, yet behaved with honor, and took no advantage, never cut down a comrade who was drunk, kept his temper and, warrior that he was, watched and controlled his God-sent strength and his outstanding natural powers. He had been poorly regarded for a long time, was taken by the Geats for less than he was worth, and their lord, too, had never much esteemed him in the mead hall. They firmly believed that he lacked force, that the prince was a weakling. But presently, every affront to his deserving was reversed. The battle-famed king, bulwark of his earls, ordered a gold-chased heirloom of Hrethel's to be brought in. It was the best example of a gem-studded sword in the Geat treasury. This he laid on Beowulf's lap, and then rewarded him with land as well, 7,000 hides, and a hall and a throne. Both owned land by birth in that country, ancestral grounds. But the greater right and sway were inherited by the higher born. A lot was to happen in later days in the fury of battle. Hugh-Lach fell, and the shelter of Heardred's shield proved useless against the fierce aggression of the Silfings. Ruthless swordsmen, seasoned campaigners, they came against him and his conquering nation, and with cruel force cut him down, so that afterwards the wide kingdom reverted to Beowulf. He ruled it well for 50 winters, grew old and wise as warden of the land, until one began to dominate the dark, a dragon on the prowl from the steep vaults of a stone-roofed barrow where he guarded a hoard. There was a hidden passage unknown to men, but someone managed to enter by it and interfere with the heathen trove. He had handled and removed a gem-studded goblet. It gained him nothing, though with the thief's wiles he had outwitted the sleeping dragon. That drove him into rage, as the people of that country would soon discover. The intruder who broached the dragon's treasure and moved him to wrath had never meant to. It was desperation on the part of a slave, fleeing the heavy hand of some master, guilt-ridden and on the run, going to ground. But he soon began to shake with terror. In shock, the wretch panicked and ran away with the precious metalwork. There were many other heirlooms heaped inside the earth house, because long ago, with deliberate care, somebody now forgotten had buried the riches of a high-born race in this ancient cache. Death had come and taken them all in times gone by, and the only one left to tell their tale, the last of their line, could look forward to nothing but the same fate for himself. He foresaw that his joy in the treasure would be brief. A newly constructed barrow stood waiting, on a wide headland close to the waves, its entryway secured. Into it the keeper of the hoard had carried all the goods and golden ware worth preserving. His words were few. "Now, earth, hold what earls once held and heroes can no more. It was mined from you first by honorable men. My own people have been ruined in war. One by one they went down to death, looked their last on sweet life in the hall. I am left with nobody to bear a sword or burnish plated goblets, put a sheen on the cup. The companies have departed. The hard helmet, hasped with gold, will be stripped of its hoops, and the helmet shiner who should polish the metal of the war mask sleeps. The coat of mail that came through all fights, through shield collapse and cut of sword, decays with the warrior. Nor may webbed mail range far and wide on the warlord's back, beside his mustered troops. No trembling harp, no tuned timber, no tumbling hawk swerving through the hall, no swift horse pawing the courtyard. Pillage and slaughter have emptied the earth of entire peoples." And so he mourned, as he moved about the world, deserted and alone, lamenting his unhappiness day and night, until death's flood brimmed up in his heart. Then, an old harrower of the dark happened to find the hoard open. The burning one who hunts out barrows, the slick-skinned dragon threatening the night sky with streamers of fire. People on the farms are in dread of him. He is driven to hunt out hoards underground, to guard heathen gold through age-long vigils, though to little avail. For 3 centuries, this scourge of the people had stood guard on that stoutly protected underground treasury, until the intruder unleashed its fury. He hurried to his lord with the gold-plated cup, and made his plea to be reinstated. Then the vault was rifled, the ring hoard robbed, and the wretched man had his request granted. His master gazed on that find from the past for the first time. When the dragon awoke, trouble flared again. He rippled down the rock, writhing with anger when he saw the footprints of the prowler who had stolen too close to his dreaming head. So may a man not marked by fate easily escape exile and woe by the grace of God. The horde guardian scorched the ground as he scoured and hunted for the trespasser who had troubled his sleep. Hot and savage, he kept circling and circling the outside of the mound. No man appeared in that desert waste, but he worked himself up by imagining battle. Then back in he'd go in search of the cup, only to discover signs that someone had stumbled upon the golden treasures. So the guardian of the mound, the hoard watcher, waited for the gloaming with fierce impatience. His pent-up fury at the loss of the vessel made him long to hit back and lash out in flames. Then, to his delight, the day waned, and he could wait no longer behind the wall, but hurtled forth in a fiery blaze. The first to suffer were the people on the land, but before long it was their treasure-giver who would come to grief. The dragon began to belch out flames and burn bright homesteads. There was a hot glow that scared everyone, for the vile sky-winger would leave nothing alive in his wake. Everywhere the havoc he wrought was in evidence. Far and near, the Geat nation bore the brunt of his brutal assaults and virulent hate. Then back to the hoard he would dart before daybreak to hide in his den. He had swinged the land, swathed it in flame, in fire and burning, and now he felt secure in the vaults of his barrow. But his trust was unavailing. Then Beowulf was given bad news, a hard truth. His own home, the best of buildings, had been burnt to a cinder, the throne room of the Geats. It threw the hero into deep anguish and darkened his mood. The wise man thought he must have thwarted ancient ordinance of the Eternal Lord, broken his commandment. His mind was in turmoil. Unaccustomed anxiety and gloom confused his brain. The fire dragon had razed the coastal region and reduced forts and earthworks to dust and ashes. So the war king planned and plotted his revenge. The warrior's protector, Prince of the Hall Troop, ordered a marvelous all-iron shield from his smithy works. He well knew that linden boards would let him down and timber burn. After many trials, he was destined to face the end of his days in this mortal world, as was the dragon, for all his long leasehold on the treasure. Yet the Prince of the Rings was too proud to line up with a large army against the Sky Plague. He had scant regard for the dragon as a threat, no dread at all of its courage or strength, for he had kept going often in the past, through perils and ordeals of every sort, after he had purged Hrothgar's hall, triumphed in Heorot, and beaten Grendel. He outgrappled the monster and his evil kin. One of his cruelest hand-to-hand encounters had happened when Hugolak, king of the Geats, was killed in Friesland. The people's friend and lord, Hrethel's son, slaked a sword-blade's thirst for blood. But Beowulf's prodigious gifts as a swimmer guaranteed his safety. He arrived at the shore, shouldering 30 battle dresses, the booty he had won. There was little for the Hetwara to be happy about, as they shielded their faces, and fighting on the ground began in earnest. With Beowulf against them, few could hope to return home. Across the wide sea, desolate and alone, the son of Edgetheow swam back to his people. There Hyd offered him throne and authority as lord of the Ringhorde. With Hygelac dead, she had no belief in her son's ability to defend their homeland against foreign invaders. Yet there was no way the weakened nation could get Beowulf to give in and agree to be elevated over Heardred as his lord, or to undertake the office of kingship. But he did provide support for the prince, honored and minded him until he matured as the ruler of Geatland. Then, over sea roads, exiles arrived, sons of Ohtera. They had rebelled against the best of all the sea kings in Sweden, the one who held sway in the Silfing nation, their renowned prince, lord of the Meadhall. That marked the end for Hygelac's son. His hospitality was mortally rewarded with wounds from a sword. Heardred lay slaughtered, and Onela returned to the land of Sweden, leaving Beowulf to ascend the throne, to sit in majesty and rule over the Geats. He was a good king. In days to come, he contrived to avenge the fall of his prince. He befriended Eadgils when Eadgils was friendless, aiding his cause with weapons and warriors over the wide sea, sending him men. The feud was settled on a comfortless campaign when he killed Onela. And so, the son of Edgetheow had survived every extreme, excelling himself in daring and in danger, until the day arrived when he had to come face to face with the dragon. The lord of the Geats took 11 comrades and went in a rage to reconnoiter. By then he had discovered the cause of the affliction being visited on the people. The precious cup had come to him from the hand of the finder, the one who had started all this strife, and was now added as a 13th to their number. They press-ganged and compelled this poor creature to be their guide. Against his will, he led them to the earth vault he alone knew, an underground barrow near the sea billows and heaving waves, heaped inside with exquisite metalwork. The one who stood guard was dangerous and watchful, warden of that trove buried under earth. No easy bargain would be made in that place by any man. The veteran king sat down on the cliff top. He wished good luck to the Geats who had shared his hearth and his gold. He was sad at heart, unsettled, yet ready, sensing his death. His fate hovered near, unknowable but certain. It would soon claim his coffered soul, part life from limb. Before long, the prince's spirit would spin free from his body. Beowulf, son of Edgetheow, spoke. "Many a skirmish I survived when I was young, and many times of war. I remember them well. At 7... I was fostered out by my father, left in the charge of my people's lord. King Hrethel kept me and took care of me, was open-handed, behaved like a kinsman. While I was his ward, He treated me no worse as a wean about the place than one of his own boys, Herebald and Hafkin, or my own Huyalak. For the eldest, Herebald, an unexpected deathbed was laid out, through a brother's doing, when Hafkin bent his horn-tipped bow and loosed the arrow that destroyed his life. He shot wide, and buried a shaft in the flesh and blood of his own brother. That offence was beyond redress, a wrong-footing of the heart's affections, for who could avenge the prince's life or pay his death price? It was like the misery felt by an old man who has lived to see his son's body swing on the gallows. He begins to keen and weep for his boy, watching the raven gloat where he hangs. He can be of no help. The wisdom of age is worthless to him. Morning after morning he wakes to remember that his child is gone. He has no interest in living on until another heir is born in the hall, now that his firstborn has entered death's dominion forever. He gazes sorrowfully at his son's dwelling, the banquet hall bereft of all delight, the wind-swept hearthstone. The horsemen are sleeping, the warrior is underground. What was is no more. No tunes from the harp, no cheer raised in the yard. Alone with his longing, he lies down on his bed and sings a lament. Everything seems too large, the steadings and the fields. Such was the feeling of loss endured by the Lord of the Geats after Herebald's death. He was helplessly placed to set to rights the wrong committed, could not punish the killer in accordance with the law of the blood feud, although he felt no love for him. Heart sore, wearied, he turned away from life's joys, chose God's light, and departed, leaving buildings and lands to his sons as a man of substance will. Then, over the wide sea, Swedes and Geats battled and feuded and fought without quarter. Hostilities broke out when Hrethel died. Ongentheow's sons were unrelenting, refusing to make peace, campaigning violently from coast to coast, constantly setting up terrible ambushes around Hrasnahill. My own kith and kin avenged these evil events, as everybody knows, but the price was high. One of them paid with his life. Hafkin, Lord of the Geats, met his fate there and fell in the battle. Then, as I have heard, Huyalak's sword was raised in the morning against Ongentheow, his brother's killer. When Eivor cleft the old Swede's helmet, halved it open, he fell, death-pale. His feud-calloused hand could not stave off the fatal stroke. The treasures that Huyalak lavished on me, I paid for when I fought, as fortune allowed me, with my glittering sword. He gave me land and the security land brings, so he had no call to go looking for some lesser champion, some mercenary from among the Giftas, or the Spear-Danes, or the men of Sweden. I marched ahead of him, always there at the front of the line. And I shall fight like that for as long as I live, as long as this sword shall last, which has stood me in good stead late and soon, ever since I killed Dayraven the Frank in front of the two armies. He brought back no looted breastplate to the Frisian king, but fell in battle, their standard-bearer, high-born and brave. No sword-blade sent him to his death. My bare hands stilled his heartbeats and wrecked the bone-house. Now, blade and hand, sword and sword-stroke, will assay the hoard. Beowulf spoke, made a formal boast for the last time. I risked my life often when I was young. Now I am old, but as king of the people, I shall pursue this fight for the glory of winning, if the evil one will only abandon his earth fort and face me in the open. Then, He addressed each dear companion one final time. Those fighters in their helmets, resolute and high-born. I would rather not use a weapon if I knew another way to grapple with the dragon and make good my boast, as I did against Grendel in days gone by. But I shall be meeting molten venom in the fire he breathes. So I go forth in mail shirt and shield. I won't shift a foot when I meet the cave guard. What occurs on the wall between the two of us will turn out as fate, overseer of men, decides. I am resolved. I scorn further words against this sky-born foe. Men-at-arms, remain here on the barrow, safe in your armor, to see which one of us is better in the end at bearing wounds in a deadly fray. This fight is not yours, nor is it up to any man except me to measure his strength against the monster or to prove his worth. I shall win the gold by my courage, or else mortal combat, doom of battle, will bear your lord away. Then he drew himself up beside his shield. The fabled warrior, in his war shirt and helmet, trusted in his own strength entirely, and went under the crag. No coward path. Hard by the rock face, that hale veteran, a good man who had gone repeatedly into combat and danger and come through, saw a stone arch and a gushing stream that burst from the barrow, blazing and wafting a deadly heat. It would be hard to survive unscathed near the hoard, to hold firm against the dragon in those flaming depths. Then he gave a shout. The lord of the Geats unburdened his breast and broke out in a storm of anger. Under gray stone his voice challenged and resounded clearly. Hate was ignited. The hoard guard recognized a human voice. The time was over for peace and parleying. Pouring forth in a hot battle fume, the breath of the monster burst from the rock. There was a rumble underground. Down there in the barrow, Beowulf the warrior lifted his shield. The outlandish thing writhed and convulsed and viciously turned on the king, whose keen-edged sword, an heirloom inherited by ancient rite, was already in his hand. Roused to a fury, each antagonist struck terror in the other. Unyielding, the lord of his people loomed by his tall shield, sure of his ground, while the serpent looped and unleashed itself. Swaddled in flames, it came gliding and flexing and racing toward its fate. Yet his shield defended the renowned leader's life and limb for a shorter time than he meant it to. That final day was the first time when Beowulf fought, and fate denied him glory in battle. So the king of the Geats raised his hand and struck hard at the enameled scales, but scarcely cut through. The blade flashed and slashed, yet the blow was far less powerful than the hard-pressed king had need of at that moment. The mound-keeper went into a spasm and spouted deadly flames. When he felt the stroke, battle-fire billowed and spewed. Beowulf was foiled of a glorious victory. The glittering sword, infallible before that day, failed when he unsheathed it, as it never should have. For the son of Egtheow, it was no easy thing to have to give ground like that and go unwillingly to inhabit another home in a place beyond. So every man must yield the leasehold of his days. Before long, the fierce contenders clashed again. The horde guard took heart, inhaled, and swelled up and got a new wind. He who had once ruled was furled in fire and had to face the worst. No help or backing was to be had then from his high-born comrades. That hand-picked troop broke ranks and ran for their lives to the safety of the wood. but within one heart sorrow welled up. In a man of worth, the claims of kinship cannot be denied. His name was Wiglaf, a son of Wechstans, a well-regarded Chilfing warrior related to Alfera. When he saw his lord tormented by the heat of his scalding helmet, he remembered the bountiful gifts bestowed on him, how well he lived among the Waymundings, the freehold he inherited from his father before him. He could not hold back. One hand brandished the yellow-timbered shield, the other drew his sword, an ancient blade that was said to have belonged to Eanmund, the son of Ochtera, the one Wechstan had slain when he was an exile without friends. He carried the arms to the victim's kinfolk, the burnished helmet, the webbed chainmail, and that relic of the giants. But Onala returned the weapons to him, rewarded Wechstan with Eanmund's war gear. He ignored the blood feud, the fact that Eanmund was his brother's son. Wechstan kept that war gear for a lifetime, the sword and the mail shirt, until it was the son's turn to follow his father and perform his part. Then, in old age, at the end of his days among the Weather Geats, he bequeathed to Wiglaf innumerable weapons. And now, the youth was to enter the line of battle with his lord, his first time to be tested as a fighter. His spirit did not break, and the ancestral blade would keep its edge, as the dragon discovered, as soon as they came together in the combat. Sad at heart, addressing his companions, Wiglaf spoke wise and fluent words. "I remember that time when mead was flowing, how we pledged loyalty to our lord in the hall, promised our ring-giver we would be worth our price, make good the gift of the war-gear, those swords and helmets, as and when his need required it. He picked us out from the army deliberately, honored us and judged us fit for this action, made me these lavish gifts, and all because he considered us the best of his arms-bearing thanes. And now, although he wanted this challenge to be one he'd face by himself alone, the shepherd of our land, a man unequaled in the quest for glory and a name for daring, now the day has come when this lord we serve needs sound men to give him their support. Let us go to him, help our leader through the hot flame and dread of the fire. As God is my witness, I would rather my body were robed in the same burning blaze as my gold-giver's body than go back home bearing arms. That is unthinkable, unless we have first slain the foe and defended the life of the Prince of the Weather Geats. I well know the things he has done for us deserve better. Should he alone be left exposed to fall in battle? We must bond together shield and helmet, mail shirt and sword. Then he waded the dangerous reek and went under arms to his lord, saying only, "Go on, dear Beowulf, do everything you said you would when you were still young and vowed you would never let your name and fame be dimmed while you lived. Your deeds are famous, so stay resolute, my lord. Defend your life now with the whole of your strength. I shall stand by you." After those words, a wildness rose in the dragon again and drove it to attack, heaving up fire, hunting for enemies, the humans it loathed. Flames lapped the shield, charred it to the boss, and the body armor on the young warrior was useless to him. But Wiglaf did well under the wide rim Beowulf shared with him once his own had shattered in sparks and ashes. Inspired again by the thought of glory, the war king threw his whole strength behind a sword stroke and connected with the skull. And nailing snapped, Beowulf's ancient iron-gray sword let him down in the fight. It was never his fortune to be helped in combat by the cutting edge of weapons made of iron. When he wielded a sword, no matter how blooded and hard-edged the blade, his hand was too strong. The stroke he dealt, I have heard, would ruin it. He could reap no advantage. Then the bane of that people, the fire-breathing dragon, was mad to attack for a third time. When a chance came, he caught the hero in a rush of flame and clamped sharp fangs into his neck. Beowulf's body ran wet with his life-blood. It came welling out. Next thing, they say, the noble son of Wechstan saw the king in danger at his side and displayed his inborn bravery and strength. He left the head alone, but his fighting hand was burned when he came to his kinsman's aid. He lunged at the enemy lower down so that his decorated sword sank into its belly, and the flames grew weaker. Once again, the king gathered his strength and drew a stabbing knife he carried on his belt, sharpened for battle. He stuck it deep into the dragon's flank. Beowulf dealt it a deadly wound. They had killed the enemy. Courage quelled his life. That pair of kinsmen, partners in nobility, had destroyed the foe. So every man should act, be at hand when needed. But now, for the king, this would be the last of his many labors and triumphs in the world. Then, the wound dealt by the ground burner earlier began to scald and swell. Beowulf discovered deadly poison suppurating inside him, surges of nausea. And so, in his wisdom, the prince realized his state and struggled towards a seat on the rampart. He steadied his gaze on those gigantic stones, saw how the earthwork was braced with arches built over columns. And now that thane, unequaled for goodness, with his own hands washed his lord's wounds, swabbed the weary prince with water, bathed him clean, unbuckled his helmet. Beowulf spoke. In spite of his wounds, mortal wounds, he still spoke, for he well knew his days in the world had been lived out to the end. His allotted time was drawing to a close. Death was very near. "Now is the time when I would have wanted to bestow this armor on my own son. Had it been my fortune to have fathered an heir and live on in his flesh. For 50 years I ruled this nation. No king of any neighboring clan would dare face me with troops. None had the power to intimidate me. I took what came, cared for and stood by things in my keeping, never fomented quarrels, never swore to a lie. All this consoles me, doomed as I am and sickening for death. Because of my right ways, the ruler of mankind need never blame me when the breath leaves my body for murder of kinsmen. Go now quickly, dearest Wiglaf, under the grey stone where the dragon is laid out, lost to his treasure. Hurry to feast your eyes on the hoard. Away you go. I want to examine that ancient gold, gaze my fill on those garnered jewels. My going will be easier for having seen the treasure. A less troubled letting go of the life and lordship I have long maintained. And so, I have heard, the son of Wechstan quickly obeyed the command of his languishing, war-weary lord. He went in his chainmail under the rock-piled roof of the barrow, exulting in his triumph, and saw beyond the seat a treasure trove of astonishing richness, wall hangings that were a wonder to behold. Glittering gold spread across the ground. The old dawn-scorching serpent's den packed with goblets and vessels from the past, tarnished and corroding. Rusty helmets all eaten away. Armbands everywhere artfully wrought. How easily treasure buried in the ground, gold hidden however skillfully, can escape from any man. And he saw, too, a standard entirely of gold hanging high over the hoard, a masterpiece of filigree. It glowed with light so he could make out the ground at his feet and inspect the valuables. Of the dragon there was no remaining sign. The sword had dispatched him. Then, the story goes, a certain man plundered the hoard in that immemorial how, filled his arms with flagons and plates, anything he wanted, and took the standard also, most brilliant of banners. Already the blade of the old king's sharp-killing sword had done its worst. The one who had for long minded the hoard, hovering over gold, unleashing fire, surging forth midnight after midnight, had been mown down. Wiglaf went quickly, keen to get back, excited by the treasure. Anxiety weighed on his brave heart. He was hoping he would find the leader of the Geats alive, where he had left him helpless, earlier on the open ground. So he came to the place, carrying the treasure, and found his lord bleeding profusely, his life at an end. Again he began to swab his body. The beginnings of an utterance broke out from the king's breast cage. The old lord gazed sadly at the gold. "To the everlasting Lord of all, to the King of Glory I give thanks that I behold this treasure here in front of me, that I have been allowed to leave my people so well endowed on the day I die. Now that I have bartered my last breath to own this fortune, it is up to you to look after their needs. I can hold out no longer. Order my troop to construct a barrow on a headland on the coast after my pyre has cooled. It will loom on the horizon at Rhonesness and be a reminder among my people, so that in coming times crews under sail will call it Beowulf's Barrow, as they steer ships across the wide and shrouded waters." Then the king, in his great-heartedness, unclasped the collar of gold from his neck and gave it to the young thane, telling him to use it and the war-shirt and the gilded helmet. "Well, you are the last of us, the only one left of the Waymundings. Fate swept us away, sent my whole brave, high-born clan to their final doom. Now I must follow them." That was the warrior's last word. He had no more to confide. The furious heat of the pyre would assail him. His soul fled from his breast to its destined place among the steadfast ones. It was hard then on the young hero, having to watch the one he held so dear there on the ground, going through his death agony. The dragon from under earth, his nightmarish destroyer, lay destroyed as well, utterly without life. No longer would his snake folds ply themselves to safeguard hidden gold. Hard-edged blades, hammered out and keenly filed, had finished him, so that the sky-roamer lay there, rigid, brought low beside the treasure lodge. Never again would he glitter and glide, and show himself off in midnight air, exulting in his riches. He fell to earth through the battle strength in Beowulf's arm. There were few indeed, as far as I have heard, big and brave as they may have been, few who would have held out if they had had to face the outpourings of that poison breather, or gone foraging on the ring hall floor and found the deep barrow dweller on guard and awake. The treasure had been won, bought and paid for by Beowulf's death. Both had reached the end of the road through the life they had been lent. Before long, the battle dodgers abandoned the wood, the ones who had let down their lord earlier, the tale turners, 10 of them together. When he needed them most, they had made off. Now they were ashamed and came behind shields in their battle outfits to where the old man lay. They watched Wiglaf, sitting worn out, a comrade shoulder to shoulder with his lord, trying in vain to bring him round with water. Much as he wanted to, there was no way he could preserve his lord's life on earth, or alter in the least the Almighty's will. What God judged right would rule what happened to every man, as it does to this day. Then a stern rebuke was bound to come from the young warrior to the ones who had been cowards. Wiglaf, son of Wehrstan, spoke disdainfully and in disappointment. Anyone ready to admit the truth will surely realize that the lord of men who showered you with gifts and gave you the armor you are standing in, when he would distribute helmets and mail shirts to men on the mead benches, a prince treating his thanes in hall to the best he could find, far or near, was throwing weapons uselessly away. It would be a sad waste when the war broke out. Beowulf had little cause to brag about his armed guard, yet God, who ordains, who wins or loses, allowed him to strike with his own blade when bravery was needed. There was little I could do to protect his life in the heat of the fray, yet I found new strength welling up when I went to help him. Then my sword connected, and the deadly assaults of our foe grew weaker, the fire coursed less strongly from his head. But when the worst happened, too few rallied around the prince. So it is goodbye now to all you know and love on your home ground. The open-handedness, the giving of war swords. Every one of you with freeholds of land, our whole nation, will be dispossessed. Once princes from beyond get tidings of how you turned and fled and disgraced yourselves. A warrior will sooner die than live a life of shame. Then he ordered the outcome of the fight to be reported to those camped on the ridge, that crowd of retainers who had sat all morning, sad at heart, shield-bearers wondering about the man they loved. Would this day be his last, or would he return? He told the truth and did not balk, the rider who bore news to the cliff-top. He addressed them all. Now the people's pride and love, the lord of the Geats, is laid on his deathbed, brought down by the dragon's attack. Beside him lies the bane of his life, dead from knife wounds. There was no way Beowulf could manage to get the better of the monster with his sword. Wiglaf sits at Beowulf's side, the son of Wehrstan, the living warrior, watching by the dead, keeping weary vigil, holding awake for the loved and the loathed. Now, war is looming over our nation. Soon it will be known to Franks and Frisians far and wide that the king is gone. Hostility has been great among the Franks since Hygelac sailed forth at the head of a war fleet into Friesland. There the Hetwara harried and attacked and overwhelmed him with great odds. The leader in his war gear was laid low, fell amongst followers. That lord did not favor his company with spoils. The Merovingian king has been an enemy to us ever since. Nor do I expect peace or pact-keeping of any sort from the Swedes. Remember, at Ravenswood, Ongentheow slaughtered Hathkin, Hrethel's son, when the Geat people in their arrogance first attacked the fierce Sylfings. The return blow was quickly struck by Ochtera's father. Old and terrible, he felled the Sea King and saved his own aged wife, the mother of Onela and of Ochtera, bereft of her gold rings. Then he kept hard on the heels of the foe and drove them, leaderless, lucky to get away, in a desperate rout into Ravenswood. His army surrounded the weary remnant where they nursed their wounds. All through the night he howled threats at those huddled survivors, promised to axe their bodies open when dawn broke, dangle them from gallows to feed the birds. But at first light, when their spirits were lowest, relief arrived. They heard the sound of Hyalak's horn, his trumpet calling as he came to find them, the hero in pursuit, at hand with troops. The bloody swath that Swedes and Geats cut through each other was everywhere. No one could miss their murderous feuding. Then the old man made his move, pulled back, barred his people in. Ongentheow withdrew to higher ground. Hyalak's pride and prowess as a fighter were known to the earl. He had no confidence that he could hold out against that horde of seamen, defend wife and the ones he loved from the shock of the attack. He retreated for shelter behind the earth wall. Then Hyalak swooped on the Swedes at bay. His banners swarmed into their refuge. His Geat forces drove forward to destroy the camp. There in his grey hairs, Ongentheow was cornered, ringed around with swords. And it came to pass that the king's fate was in Eivor's hands and in his alone. Wolf, son of Onered, went for him in anger, split him open, so that blood came spurting from under his hair. The old hero still did not flinch, but parried fast, hit back with a harder stroke. The king turned and took him on. Then Onered's son, the brave Wolf, could land no blow against the aged lord. Ongentheow divided his helmet so that he buckled and bowed his bloodied head and dropped to the ground. But his doom held off. Though he was cut deep, he recovered again. With his brother down, the undaunted Eivor, Hyalak's thane, hefted his sword and smashed murderously at the massive helmet past the lifted shield. And the king collapsed. The shepherd of people was sheared of life. Many then hurried to help Wolf, bandaged and lifted him now that they were left masters of the blood-soaked battleground. One warrior stripped the other, looted Ongentheow's iron mail coat, his hard sword hilt, his helmet too, and carried the Graith to King Hyalak. He accepted the prize, promised fairly that reward would come, and kept his word. For their bravery in action, when they arrived home, Eivor and Wolf were overloaded by Hrethel's son, Hyalak the Geat, with gifts of land and linked rings that were worth a fortune. They had won glory, so there was no gainsaying his generosity. And he gave Eivor his only daughter to bide at home with him, an honor and a bond. So, this bad blood between us and the Swedes, this vicious feud, I am convinced, is bound to revive. They will cross our borders and attack in force when they find out that Beowulf is dead. In days gone by, when our warriors fell and we were undefended, he kept our coffers and our kingdom safe. He worked for the people. But as well as that, he behaved like a hero. We must hurry now to take a last look at the king, and launch him, lord and lavisher of rings, on the funeral road. His royal pyre will melt no small amount of gold. heaped there in a hoard, it was bought at heavy cost. And that pile of rings he paid for at the end with his own life will go up with the flame, be furled in fire. Treasure no follower will wear in his memory, nor lovely woman link and attach as a torque around her neck. But often, repeatedly, in the path of exile, they shall walk bereft, bowed under woe, now that their leader's laugh is silenced, high spirits